One of those, for instance, is not letting troops, American troops, which are scattered all over the globe, become stranded overseas, sometimes in hostile lands, sometimes in indifferent lands, and not letting their weapons fall into the wrong hands. The United States maintains over 1,000 military bases around the world. A lot of them don't actually serve much of a purpose, and they require a functioning civilian economy in order to resupply those bases. They're not self-sufficient. They use copious amounts of fossil fuels, basically oil-derived things like gasoline and diesel. And that is really not something that this country will be able to keep going after the economy shuts down. So I would see, I would think that repatriating those soldiers as soon as possible, shutting down and cleaning up the bases, bringing all this war material back into the United States or destroying it, these are all excellent ideas. Another thing that I would like to see done is secure all the nuclear fuel and nuclear installations. After the fall of the Soviet Union, by a happy accident more than anything else, none of the fissile material fell into the hands of terrorists, and there were no Chernobyl-like disasters. There were some reports of radiation leaks, but nothing to rival Chernobyl. I really don't want to see fissile material falling into the wrong hands, and also I don't want to see nuclear power plants become abandoned if there is no if there is no way to maintain them. So they should be shut down, and the nuclear fuel that's stored at those locations should be transferred to someplace safer. Another thing I would like to see done is a gradual whittling down of the prison population instead of a chaotic general amnesty when the resources to maintain that prison population run out. Luckily, that is already starting to happen because various states, even prosperous ones like Connecticut, are paroling nonviolent offenders. A lot of them are there because of drug charges, because of draconian drug laws. And they're paroling them ahead of time because they're running out of money. So that's really a good trend. And lastly, the last thing I would like to see happen is there are a lot of unrepayable debts that are still carried on the books, being treated as repayable, and it's just a waste of effort. And I think that a general jubilee, a forgiveness of all of these unrepayable debts, a giant reset would be very therapeutic and helpful and wipe the slate clean. And if we do it while there's still some scope for government action, because the government isn't shut down due to lack of resources, you know, that would actually, that might help people prepare, you know, bring in some element of reality into people's lives. So those are basically the things that I half-jokingly thought would be worth doing, because I don't expect them to be done.
Well, you sound really sane to me. You've got my vote. You know, even if the economy somehow stumbles along, most of those things need to be done so that we could retool into a really sustainable life with a really productive economy again. Now, I don't want to belabor this point, but you've talked about collapse. Can you fairly briefly try and say why you think the situation in America is so serious?
Well, if you look at energy specifically, it's really clear what is about to happen, what is unfolding as we speak, really. The United States imports over two-thirds of petroleum and petroleum products at this point. It's the single biggest contribution to the trade deficit. It's beginning to dwarf the trade imbalance with China, for instance. It probably will after the price of oil doubles a few more times. And that is not really a sustainable scenario, because what's happening now is that Americans are printing more and more money with which to buy oil, but the nations that sell oil don't really want any more dollars, because it's not really a very trustworthy currency at this point. It keeps depreciating. So they'll be holding back their reserves. Another effect that's happening is exporting nations, which most of them are post-peak, and are basically looking to conserve their patrimony in terms of their oil endowment. They don't really want to squander it. If in a situation where you can cut down your oil exports, say by a factor of two, and the price of oil in as a response to that will go up by a factor of two, then it's a wash, but you have more oil left. So they would probably try to squelch their oil exports as opposed to boost them, which is not good news for the U.S. And lastly, they're so flush with revenue from their oil exports that as they invest this revenue in their own economy, their economies grow and consume more energy, meaning that there is less oil available for export. So all of those things combined mean that the U.S. is going to be maybe gradually, maybe suddenly, but cut off from two-thirds of all the oil that's required to run this economy. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that it's really all built around oil. There's very little that can happen economically in the United States that does not require oil. And if we, say, wanted to build something that doesn't run on oil, right, that runs on solar or hydro or you know, horse manure or what have you, you have to go and take out a loan. Now, what's going to be the collateral for that loan? Well, it's going to be things that run on oil, right? Jet aircraft, heavy equipment, what have you. And as you're constructing that thing, you're going to be using oil. So it's not likely that all of that equipment that burns oil is going to be very valuable as collateral if oil is in short supply. So you won't get that loan. So basically all of those things put together mean that there isn't really much of a future for an economy in the United States of the size that exists today. It's going to be much smaller. Now, a smaller economy cannot maintain and service a huge debt. So that means bankruptcy.
We're talking with Dmitry Orlov. His new book is Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. It's just out from New Society Publishers. Well, you know, when I'm thinking about what happened in the Soviet Union, I've got this sort of fuzzy picture like, well, we won or something, and then maybe the mafia had a role, and it's all very mixed up with Yeltsin in there drinking heavily, perhaps. We really don't know anything about it. What could you tell us about what happened in the Soviet Union and how that might apply to future events right here in North America?
Well, a lot of things went wrong in the Soviet Union, you know, too many to count. But what really made the whole proposition of maintaining the empire untenable was, again, energy. Russian oil production peaked a few years, about 3 years, something like that, before the Soviet Union collapsed. Oil was what allowed Russia to earn foreign currency with which to buy grain on the world market from the United States, from Canada. And the Soviet Union became complacent during the years when they were flush with oil production and oil prices were high. They were very high in the 70s, relatively. And so they became complacent, and they got used to this way of behaving where they thought they could just continue to buy whatever they needed from the West. Now, what happened after their production peaked is it coincided with the North Sea in Norway and the UK and Prudhoe Bay in Alaska coming on stream. And suddenly there was a miraculous economy, recovery of the economies of the West, which was wrongly attributed to Thatcherite Reaganite politics, but really it just had to do with the fact that oil was suddenly cheap again. But what that meant for the Soviet Union is they suddenly saw their revenues plummet, but they became so dependent on these imports that they had to borrow money in order to continue receiving them. And the Soviet Union at the very end started taking on foreign debt at a rate that could not be sustained. And that put it pretty much at the mercy of foreign creditors. You know, it made Soviet foreign policy basically a dead letter. You know, so the collapse of the Berlin Wall from that point on was just basically, you know, creditors demanding their pound of flesh.
Well, that could certainly happen. In America, we're seeing some of the oil-rich governments buying into American banks, buying into American real estate. Pretty soon they may be able to call some tunes, do you think?
I think they're already doing it to a fair extent. It used to be that the U.S. government thought that, you know, some foreign government took their reserves, you know, treasury paper, and sold it and tried to buy their way into the American economy, basically snapping up private equity. That would be considered almost like an act of war. That policy went by the wayside some time ago, you know, which is a sign of desperation. And now we have sovereign wealth funds buying up big chunks of banks. Whenever a bailout is required, they're basically invited to the table. And what that really is a surrender of sovereignty. So that, for instance, the Saudis will be able to rent or buy outright big chunks of the Midwest and grow food there and export it, even if there's malnutrition and starvation in the United States. And the people in this country won't be able to do very much about it. Yes, this country is being surrendered piece by piece to foreign creditors.
Another example I could take from Soviet history seems serious to me. Just take a second here. Back in 1932, when the main cities, particularly Moscow, ran out of food for the citizens, the troops were sent out into the country to grab anything they could find from the farmers, even the seeds for next year's planting. I think that could happen again. I mean, no government, even in nice countries like Canada or Britain, supposedly, is going to let masses of people in the big cities get too hungry. So the powers that be to feed the cities will go out and get whatever they need. And I wonder, you know, our food's coming from the other side of the world right now. The whole city system seems a bit unstable to me. Would you agree with that premise?
Well, there are things that can be done in many cities. It depends. For instance, you know, Las Vegas or Phoenix, Arizona, nothing will ever grow there. They don't have water. There's plenty of sunshine, but no water. But there are various other places which basically can reform themselves Havana style. For instance, instead of importing vegetables into the city, you can import dirt. And you only have to import the dirt once. And then people convert parking lots into raised bed agriculture by nailing together boxes. And they convert highways, because there's no traffic anymore, because there's no oil, into water catchment systems for irrigation. You know, they grow chickens and rabbits and guinea pigs and whatever else you can, you know, on their rooftops and balconies, and they can stay fed that way. It's a different approach, but it's viable, and it's actually more viable than a rural population that isn't really used to being self-sufficient. They usually grow one or two cash crops, but then they go shopping to the supermarket, which can be quite a distance away and requires them to drive. So once that lifestyle is no longer available to them, the rural scene is much more difficult to make sustainable in some ways than the city scene, where a concerted effort can be made and the people are right there to do it.
Well, this is one of the things I like about your work. It isn't just a negative put down at all. You do offer a lot of really useful ideas about rethinking and reorganizing our lives. In a way, we might all come out better in the long run. In fact, you say young people could thrive after the crash. How could that be?
Well, there are a lot of things that are quite ridiculous. You know, having gone through this educational system for a while, you know, there is a certain ridiculous aspect to you know, the success scenario as it's being touted, you know, basically going through lots and lots of courses, cramming for tests and learning lots of things that you then quickly forget, because it's really all a test of short-term memory. You know, because that's how the educational system is really structured. I find that is fairly ridiculous. I think saddling yourself with educational debt, as a lot of students in the U.S. have to do, and then being forced to take on some soulless corporate job instead of doing what you want with your life, and just basically wasting a huge chunk of your life doing things that you were initially not really interested in at all, because, you know, that they wouldn't have occurred to you except that those were the choices you were given. All of those things can be replaced with something, you know, a lot more, you know, sustaining, spiritually sustaining. For instance, you know, if instead of going through engineering school, as I did, I went through an apprenticeship and became a boat builder, for instance, I probably wouldn't have wasted so many years doing things I wasn't interested in before I got into boats. That's just a personal example, but everybody is really interested in something, and most of the time they don't get to do it because the economy doesn't require it, because there's no profit in it for whoever runs the economy. And so if the profit motive is destroyed in a collapse, it's sort of a reset, and people get to think about what they really want and how little they can get away with doing of the things that they don't want to do. And I think it's a much, much saner way to live in some ways.
Well, I was just at a car-free festival, you know, where they closed down the streets and people came out and celebrated just being alive. There were a lot of young people there. It gave me quite a bit of hope, and I thought, well, yeah, this is what the city really could be like without this oil-based economy. And there could be some new movements and a lot of involvement and a lot of community building ahead of us.
Absolutely. My whole life now is one big car-free festival. I've given up on cars a few years ago. I just bicycle everywhere. I bicycle and I sail. You know, I bought a tank of gas for my sailboat. I have a little outboard to push it around in and out of the marina. I bought it a few months ago. I think it'll last me halfway through the summer. I think I might go through 2 gas tanks this year. So, you know, I'm a little bit fossil fuel dependent, but nothing like the people who drive back and forth all day.
We're chatting with Dmitry Orlov. He's the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, just out from New Society Publishers. He has a lot of friends like James Howard Kunstler, KMO, Rand Preer, Jan Lundberg, and Matt Savinar. And they're all listed as part of Club Orlov, and that's where you can tune into Dmitry's site on the web. Orlov is spelled O-R-L-O-V. His blog is cluborlov.blogspot.com. Well, I notice your publisher, Dmitry, is based in Canada, and I know you've just finished a lot of interviews with right-wing radio hosts in the United States. The right seems to own the AM talk show dial down there. Do you have trouble finding a publisher, and what's the main reaction from these radio jocks? Do they call you a commie, or do they resist it, or are they listening?
And as far as the publisher, it was really no problem finding the publisher. So, but as far as the radio thing, I think the thing that depresses me is, if anything, is that, you know, I've been able to reach many, many, many people, but none of them seem to read books. So they're sitting in their cars, they're listening to the radio, they may have, you know, laughed, cried, whatever, but none of them probably went and bought my book.
Well, they don't read. I'm going to disagree with you. I'll bet you find that some of them did. People sort of react with denial at first, but there are still a few book readers out there. And, well, it's good that you're on radio with us now, because for those who like to listen to their information, they're getting it straight from you. And I wanted to ask you, before we close off, is there something else that you'd really like to talk about, something that my questions haven't reached?
Well, I really want to stress something that, you know, very few people point out. There's this great division between the big picture. It's important to know what's going on in the big world, you know, to have the big picture, to have this realization that, you know, the mass media is really hiding the truth from us in a lot of ways, and you have to find your own truth, and it's fairly difficult. But once you do, you can form your own picture of what's going on in the world. And at the same time, it's very important to do practical things in your own life, and a lot of people have trouble making that transition. You know, a lot of people's lives lack the flexibility to make incremental changes. And I just want to say that it's easy and pleasant. Like, you know, I got rid of my car, and you know, that was, you know, an abrupt transition, and I felt uncomfortable for a little while because I had a lot of habits that centered around the car, as we all do, that had to basically die away over a period of time. And similar changes can be made, and they seem like wrenching changes, but in retrospect, they don't seem that wrenching. So I would encourage people to experiment with their lives. Don't just passively absorb the big picture and become depressed by it, or you know, have some other reactions, but not really do anything about it, because you can't do something about it. It's just that it doesn't concern the big world. It concerns you, the people you know, the relationships around you, and what you do.
Well, that's some really good advice. I know people do watch the screen or go on the net, and they get somewhat stunned by it all, and they're too busy trying to make a living to do anything. But I agree with you. I'm trying to make incremental changes. I've changed my diet. I'm heading towards vegetarianism, for example. And I think all of those things will eventually add up, and they certainly pay off for me with better health and lower costs. So I want to thank Dmitry Orlov for coming on Radio EcoShock. We've barely scratched the surface. Maybe we can have you back again in the fall, and I don't mean the fall of civilization. I mean next autumn, if you're willing.
Absolutely. It would be a pleasure.
Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, speaking last week with Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, ecoshock.org. What should our priorities be in a time of impending social and environmental chaos? Food is a non-negotiable requirement, and our next speaker will address food freedom. She's the famous Indian physicist turned activist, Vandana Shiva. Dr. Shiva is the founding director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in New Delhi. She's also the author of numerous books, including Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply. Certain financial commentators explain the rise in food prices as the result of economic growth leading to an improved standard of living in countries like China and India. According to Shiva, India is experiencing a sharpening divide. The result of corporate globalization has been an increase in hunger among the country's rural majority as a result of policies that are destroying their local food systems to ensure profits for multinational agribusiness. This talk was given in 2007 at the University of British Columbia.
To me, freedom basically means the ability to be able to live through your decisions, your choices, without trampling on the freedoms of others. And in the case of food, for farmers, it means being able to grow it. It means being able to have access to the seeds that enable them to grow food. For all of us who are eaters, it means freedom from the threat of not having enough, the malnutrition that affects a billion people. Or not having the right food, the malnutrition that affects 2 billion people and is at the root of the obesity and diabetes epidemic of the world. It's also freedom to be able to choose the food according to your cultural context, culturally appropriate foods. It's freedom to be able to be free of denying other species and other generations their right. And therefore, built into the food freedom is the ability to grow food in ways that doesn't destroy the water systems and leave a water famine, that doesn't destroy and destabilize the climate and threaten us with a kind of climate chaos that is already hitting us. And if all the scientific predictions have to be taken seriously, we could, within the century, make this planet not just bereft of anything edible, but bereft of all conditions to live. So food freedom is an extremely composite freedom. And food fascism is the opposite of it. It's the prevention of farmers from having access to their seed through new property rights laws that have created a property in life itself, that treat seed which reproduces freely, multiplies freely, and has been exchanged freely, now to be treated as the intellectual property of a handful of corporations. And in fact, it's this property rights creation in seed that led me to establish Navdanya, to do something very basic, start saving seeds, so that at least somewhere we would have seeds that were not genetically engineered, not the property of a corporation, and embodied freedom. Because seed patterns are based on 3 violations of freedom. First, they violate the freedom of seed itself. It's in the nature of seed to renew and reproduce. And a patent says you cannot reproduce. It's in the nature of seed to be shared. A patent claim says seed sharing is illegal. Exchanging seed is now an intellectual property crime. And finally, it's a violation of freedom of the seed because it treats evolution itself as an infringement on property rights. It has literally reached the ultimate criminalization, the criminalization of nature, of biodiversity, and of farmers doing their rightful duty. I know in our culture, and definitely in all cultures, the worst sin you could commit is to exhaust seed. And I remember when I was growing up in our region, which the British took over in 1815, but just before that it was ruled by the Gorkhas, which is now the little country called Nepal. They had quite a large empire at that time. And during the big Gorkha War, they found that there were people in the huts who had died of hunger, but the seed banks were full because you could not touch the seed. Because seed had to be left for the future. You could sacrifice your life, but not the seed which carries the future. And of course, there are many ways in which fascism in food is being established through what I have called a seed dictatorship in the form of intellectual property rights. It began with very twisted definition of a treaty called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement of the WTO. They should just have said stealing the seed treaty. Of course, if they'd said that, no one would have agreed to sign on. And the reason TR was put before IP was there was nothing trade-related about this. It was a total invasion into the freedom spaces of species and into the freedom spaces of agrarian societies and farmers. Trade-related was put there, and then the Washington lawyers were absolutely brilliant, as by now you know through NAFTA. They can turn anything into anything, including the opposite of what it was. And they put trade-related and just said to the rest of the world, it's trade-related by definition, so now you can't argue about whether a WTO is the right place to enforce property rights on plant material. And later, Monsanto, as some of you might know, my very favorite company, went on record to say, in drafting this agreement, we were the patient, the diagnostician, and the physician all in one. We defined the problem, and the problem was farmers save seeds. Seed renews itself. And we offered the solution, and the solution was criminalize seed saving. Make seed the invention of corporations. And that, of course, doesn't work in the context of third world countries where the majority of seed is still the farmer's seed, particularly seed evolved by women farmers over millennia. In the case of India, it's 80%. 80% of the seed supply is farmers' own supply. 20% used to come from the public system. Now, you can't monopolize seed if 80% is free seed. And so you have to prevent that 80% freedom space from existing too. And that is done through a series of mechanisms. One mechanism is compulsory registration. Seed laws that say a farmer cannot grow their seed unless it's licensed. And the criteria of licensing is the same industrial criteria. That's tell the farmer, sorry, your seed does not fulfill the criteria of uniformity and distinctiveness and utility, and therefore you can't have a license. I've just had a farmer in Germany tell me that his family has been breeding a potato variety, very famous, very popular, the most popular potato variety, and the potato variety's name is Linda. So this potato variety called Linda, out of the blue, suddenly the government says they can't sell it because now Monsanto's ready with their BT potato. Fascism has always come out of fear. All kinds of dictatorship has come out of fear. And today's global corporate rule comes out of the most fundamental fear of anything that can thrive on its own terms and doesn't need centralized control, centralized inputs, centralized permission. There are other freedoms that start to disappear. And one of the freedoms that troubles me deeply is the freedom to have full knowledge about any situation. It could be the kind of freedom that's taken away when a farmer in India is not told in an honest way that a BT cotton is a cotton with genes from a soil bacterium that produces toxins in the plant, in every cell of the plant. That's not what a farmer is told. He's merely told he has a miracle variety that will make him a millionaire, nothing less than that. And a decision on agriculture is moved into the realm of mycology, and I am not exaggerating. The ads that Monsanto uses are ads out of our Ramayana, our sacred epic. And for those of you who know anything about the Ramayana, there was a point at which, Sita, Ram's wife, had been abducted by Ravan, and then there was a little war, and it was the monkeys, because Ram was out in the wilderness, and he didn't have an army. For 14 years, he had given up his kingdom. So all he had was the monkeys of the forest. And Hanuman was asked during the war, when Lakshman, Ram's brother, was deeply wounded, he was asked to bring a herb from this mountain where it grew. But he couldn't identify the herb, so he carried the whole mountain, called Govardhan. So a lot of Indian imagery has the Hanuman god flying with this mountain. And all of Monsanto's ads in the 1990s that I saw in the areas of Andhra Pradesh and Warangal were the seeds of cotton being carried by Hanuman. They were now the new deliverance for the farmer. And Punjab, I have seen Guru Nanak Dev being used in advertising. Or posters saying Radhe Shyam got 2,000 kilograms per acre. Become a miracle farmer like Radhe Shyam. So we actually went and hunted up Radhe Shyam in Madhya Pradesh. Here he'd grown 2,000 kilograms, except it was in 5 acres and not one. Comes to an average of 4, which is the normal yield farmers get with BT cotton. But when they imagine they're going to get 200,000, and here's a wonderful crop that'll have no pests, farmers get into this seed supply. It goes hand in hand with another part of food fascism, which is called seed replacement. You actually ensure you take away the seeds of the farmers, so that when they have to go to the season next year, they have nothing of their own. They just have to keep buying annually. And seed replacement has become the normal way in which seed monopolies are established. Across the country, 150,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide in the last decade, since the new seeds entered, first hybrid and then genetically engineered. The escalation is huge. We have a map done by a local organization that the intensity of farmers' suicides is directly proportional to the sale of BT cotton seeds. No farmers are committing suicides where they have a diversified seed supply. Not a single organic farmer has committed suicide in India. Because when you do organic, you do a positive economy. You spend less, you earn more, you grow quality products, everything has more resilience. Food fascism, through control of the seed, is literally taking away the lives of farmers. It's not just uprooting them from the land, it's killing them. I have called it a genocide. Because a genocide is any policy which targets a particular group to destroy them, partially or fully, and cause them physical harm. But under the globalized food fascism, we are seeing a genocide on our farms across the world, where small farmers are being pushed to annihilation. In countries like Canada, they leave the farm, there's something you could do in a city. In countries like India, which is still 65% farmers, there's no option outside leaving the farm, because even the cities, it's now being made illegal to be poor. Another aspect of food fascism, and that fascism is related to the fact that economies like India are so huge in size, in numbers of people, in terms of the food cultures, the food diversity. Every nook and corner you can find food. Someone's making a samosa, someone's making a chai, chana bhatura. There's no dearth of what you can get on the streets. And there is a WHO study that shows that hot cooked food on India's street is totally safe. When my friends fall ill, they usually fall ill in 5-star restaurants. You know, when you have that kind of ability to freeze food, you'll always serve stale food. Whereas when you have one little fire and one little pot, you've got to cook everything you've got in that pot and sell it by the evening because there's no place to store. Well, we've just had two laws passed dealing with both of them. One, as in the usual double speak of globalization, is called the food safety law. But it has basically, its purpose is to strike down the 9-phase food safety laws we had. It's designed just like the trade-related intellectual property rights is designed to monopolize seed. The food safety law of India is designed to be harmonized with another treaty of the WTO called the Sanitary and Phytosanitary Agreement. And this is a fascinating agreement, as is the National Food Safety Law, which derives from it. It defines safety in very deep Cartesian ways. Smallness is dangerous. It's a hazard to health. Standardization becomes the norm for safety. Safety has now been redefined as deregulating the hazardous and policing the diverse. So there are clauses in these laws about standards, and the standards are always about the size. If you bring in the tiny bananas from Kerala into an international market, it's going to kill you. You've got to have the Del Monte giant-sized rocks that you call bananas. Look, India, I don't know how many of you are aware, is the biggest producer of bananas in the world. 1,500 varieties. Have you ever seen Indian trade in bananas? No. Because it won't pass trade law. And trade law is designed to ensure that the monopolies in trade gain. They want to move things around thousands of miles. Local markets are too tedious. So freshness is counterproductive. And it's precisely for that long, large distance transport. I don't know how many of you are aware. You know, I think last March it was, President Bush came into India and said he'd give us nukes if we would give him nuked mangoes. And that was supposed to be, you know, the agreement on agriculture with the agreement on the nuclear treaty. Now, nuked mangoes are considered safe. Organic mangoes are not. They're dangerous. We have 1,500 varieties of mangoes, too. And mango, as you know, its scientific name is Madhuka indica, originated and domesticated in India. Now, most of our wonderful mangoes are meant to be eaten fresh. But once you start doing processing and long-distance transport, first, you want fruits to have hides, not to have skins. And then, of course, you want them to sit on shelves forever and pretend to look fresh, which is why they did that crazy experiment that's been a total failure. No one accepted it. How many of you are old enough to remember the Flavor Saver tomato? Well, this is a tomato whose flavor got saved by removing it. Yeah. The antisense gene basically didn't sense the aging, and you could have a rotten tomato pretending to look fresh, just like they have the Botoxing. I mean, wrinkles, which are supposed to indicate how old you are in tomatoes and people, are now to be removed so you can be thoroughly deceived. Well, Indian law on food safety has two clauses. And, I've called it the law for food fascism. It got passed through while the entire parliament was busy trying to prevent Mr. Bush from having a nuclear agreement with India. And these two clauses that stand side by side say, selling of substandard food. Substandard food is food that is safe but does not fit into the standards, which is the issue of size. Fine for this is 500,000 rupees. Death due to hazardous food. Someone dying because of food hazards. And usually you die when food has huge doses of chemicals or it has super-resistant E. coli because of factory farming. The fine for that too, for killing someone, is 500,000 rupees and for bringing a small potato to the local market is 500,000 rupees. Equal crimes. So I'm going to, sometime this year, do what we had to do when an earlier issue, before this law was brought, But in the agribusiness, which is seeking global markets through laws of uniformity, had already started to seek the Indian market. And I remember it was 98. The soya lobby wanted to grab the Indian market for oil. We have so much edible oil. We are the capital of edible oil in the world. In the south, in Kerala, they'll cook with coconut. In the north, we cook with mustard. In the Deccan, they will cook with sesame. In Gujarat, they like to cook with groundnut. Every region has its plants and its edible oils and its food culture. Well, overnight, the Indian edible oils were banned, and soya oil started to flood the market. And the slum women called me up and said, our children aren't going to sleep. They're hungry. They will not eat food cooked in soya. Bring our mustard back. And I started to first do the research about what had happened. And then we had the normal campaign that you have to do when law is used to take away freedom. And the use of law to take away freedom is precisely what fascism is. So we made mustard oil, pure organic mustard oil. I brought it to the market and I invited the chief minister of Delhi to receive the first bottle. The chief minister lost his job. Mustard survived. Recently, the Supreme Court of India has banned street foods. We're going to have to do something about that too. Probably we'll have a street food celebration and festival, and we will have to tell the courts, this is following Gandhi. And just like the British tried to tell us not to make our own salt, the courts, our own courts, when they tell us we can't make our own food, this is fascism, we will have to disobey to defend our food freedom. And it's a violation of freedom of those who could not afford any other economy. The minute you get into a restaurant, you're having to pay for the air conditioning, running water, electricity, the waiters. All of that cost is cut down on the streets. India has, as I mentioned, 650 million farmers, rural people. And it has 40 million tiny trade, including the street food hawkers. Including one of my best favorite sounds is opening my eyes in the morning and you will hear, tomato, 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 windy, windy, windy. And the local vegetable vendor is going through on his little push cart, door to door, telling you, I've got these fresh vegetables. And you peep out of the balcony, you can be in your night clothes, and just tell him how much you need, and he brings it to you. What could be a more economic service, especially in these times of climate change? Zero carbon emissions, right at your doorstep. And yet, just the day before, the U.S. ambassador is holding up his finger on India and saying it had better open up its retail market to Walmart. That's 40 million people losing their livelihoods. Whether it is the seed, the distribution, processing, at every level, the spaces for freedom are being appropriated, not naturally. There's nothing natural about going from a fresh food culture to a canned food culture. There's nothing natural about going from delivery at your doorstep to a hypermarket 20 miles away where you have to drive. All this is institutionalized through a very violent system, an extremely coercive system. And yet it is constantly naturalized. It's made to look like this is a natural evolution. Farmers must disappear. Small farms must become giant farms. Fresh food must give way to processed food. Good seed must give way to genetic engineering. The levels of coercion are at every level, beginning with the World Trade Organization rules. And if it wasn't coercive, why on earth would there be a problem in negotiations right now? It's collapsing. Since Seattle, when for the first time it became very clear what these rules were about, it's not that easy for the Cargills to push in their monopolies through the agriculture agreement, for Monsanto to push in further in monopolies, though Monsanto has used the WTO last year against Europe. Europe did not accept genetically engineered food. Tony Blair would have liked to, because he was so close first to Clinton and then to Bush. He was always ready to work for them. And yet the citizens of England were not. And I remember one of the early days when I went to England to launch the GMO freeze campaign, where they wanted a freeze on the introduction of genetic engineering. one of the loveliest actions was old women getting into supermarkets, loading their carts with things, and coming out and asking for everything, "Can you give me a guarantee whether this has genetic engineering in it?" And the poor salesperson would say, "Let me go check out." And they were just running and running and running. And there were jams, and nothing could be sold. And eventually, the supermarkets realized the only way they'd be able to sell stuff is by saying, "We have no GMOs in our stocks." And one after the other, supermarket chains started to declare themselves GMO-free. And it took tiny actions like that. But Monsanto would like to overturn those democratic achievements of the people of Europe. And I think it was in 3 years ago, the United States initiated a dispute in the WTO. And WTO is also interesting in this. You know, normal democracies have an executive, a judiciary, and they have a parliament. And the three bring balance on the functioning of each. In the case of WTO, WTO is all in one. Yeah? It's the law writer, so it's the global parliament, without votes and without democracy. It's a parliament that legislates food fascism. It's the executive that implements it. And it's the court that, through its dispute settlement mechanism, does ruling to say, you can't go off the track. Food fascism has to be the obligation of every country, even if those laws of food fascism go against our national laws and our constitutions. And in the case of the European dispute, WTO did what it was supposed to do. It ruled against Europe, that European citizens have no freedom to choose what they will eat. Monsanto's freedom to sell GMOs is a higher freedom. This is forced choice. It's not democracy. And it's being furthered through the new awareness on climate change. I mean, the genetic engineering industry is trying to push and enlarge its scope through two means. One, through pretending that without genetic engineering, we won't be able to deal with climate change. Even the Stern report, excellent report from the UK government, has this huge chapter on how we'll have to breed new crops and use new technologies to cope with climate change. Now, there are three primary impacts of climate change. The first is more intensified drought. The second is more intensified flooding. The third impact of climate change is intensified hurricanes and cyclones. We saw Katrina. And that normally means both also sea level rise. The combination of all of it means you need more drought-tolerant crops, you need more flood-tolerant crops, and you need more salt-tolerant crops. Well, you don't need genetic engineering to do this. In any case, the best genetic engineering would do is take the genes nature has given, farmers have evolved, and merely discover them. Discovery does not call. It's not the equivalent of invention, and therefore cannot be patentable. Because the other day I had journalists say, "Oh, so-and-so says they have made a new genetically engineered organism with saline-resistant genes in it." And I had to read out to him all the saline-resistant crops of rice that we have in our Navdanya collection. Varieties of rice like Skalambank, Kartik Patini, Chakaki, Dalat Patini, Dudeshwar, Leelapati, Luna. Luna literally means salt in East Indian languages. And some of these we used after the supercyclone in Orissa, which had three times the velocity of normal cyclones in 98. After the tsunami in Tamil Nadu, and there are other Bay of Bengal countries that are now coming to us, to our seed banks, to collect some of these rices that farmers have evolved to be able to deal with salinity resistance. And in the case of drought resistance, some of the forgotten foods that we in Navdanya promote, the millets like ragi and jangora, all the wonderful amaranth, all of them use as little as 200 to 300 millimeters of rain. The best you could do with genetic engineering is, after having unleashed Green Revolution rice varieties, which shot up the water use by 10 times, because you now needed to dissolve the chemicals, the best you do is reduce that 2,500 millimeters that those rices need down to 2,000. And here you can have 40 times more nutrition by going to the crops that have been forgotten in the industrial agriculture and industrial breeding system. It is to a very large extent about forgetting. And the biodiversity that nature has given us and farmers have evolved is our best bet at overcoming both hunger as well as dealing with the vulnerabilities that climate chaos forces on us. In terms of hunger, I always think of the genetically engineered golden rice. You remember it was supposed to get rid of blindness? And why were children going blind? Because there was too little vitamin A. Why was there too little vitamin A? Because the greens in our fields had been sprayed out by herbicides and Roundup. Natural sources of vitamin A had been destroyed. The golden rice would have 30 micrograms of vitamin A equivalent after 10 years of breeding and billions of years, billions of dollars of investment, and about 80 patents to protect it. There's a red rice we have in our collection that has more vitamin A. But we don't turn to rice for vitamin A. As any grandmother will tell you, you need vitamin A, eat your coriander. Eat your curry patta. That's why we have those wonderful chutneys in the Indian cuisine. And more recently, I don't know how many of you found out, in Kansas, they are now introducing a genetically engineered rice with human genes in it. I call it the cannibal rice. And of course, again, what you know, the thing is, we're going to save children from dying from diarrhea, you know, blindness, diarrhea. They've become the saviors of the world. Mothers can't be relied on. The biotech industry has to be handed over the fate of our children. Well, you know, traditionally, every home in India has given a rice kanji as a diarrhea cure. It's the oral rehydration. You don't have to genetically engineer rice and put human genes into it to give a solution to diarrheal deaths. And of course, at every point, this is about, I think 30,000 hectares have already been given permission in Kansas to be planted. Contamination is a guarantee. And the United States has already lost huge amounts of shipments, orders, because of the contamination of its rice last year. There's a second aspect of climate change that's being used to push through GMOs, and that is related to the new obsession with biofuels. And the stocks of, in the minute Europe introduced its biofuel policy, the biotech industry stock shot up, because the industry said people care about the food they eat, they won't care about what goes into your petrol tank. But people are not just worried about genetically engineered crops, because of the food issues and the risks and the untested nature of these crops and foods. They also care about the known risks of genetic contamination, about the destruction of biodiversity. And that won't be avoided by this huge unleashing of GMOs on millions of hectares. Let me just share with you some of these figures that come out of various studies that are now being done. David Pimentel of Cornell has shown that if you use corn for biofuel, you spend 28,000 kilocalories for a gallon. You get out of it 19,000 kilocalories. You spend more energy making the industrial biofuel. In the U.S., only 1% of the oil is today from biofuels, but it's already using 20% of the corn. And if all of the corn had to be used that's grown, 7% of oil would be replaced, which means we would still need 93% for the United States from some other source, and it would mean no corn for food, or no corn for feed, or cattle feed. An Italian called Sergio Giotti has just done some calculations and shown that if the European objectives of meeting biofuel targets have to be met, Italy will have 69% more arable land than it has, and 102% more water, and 40% additional chemicals would have to be sprayed. But quite clearly, this does not fit into the ecological limits of the planet, and it definitely does not fit into the fact that the most important reason we grow crops is to eat. And if 1 billion people are already hungry, then there is no luxury of diverting millions and millions and millions of acres to genetically engineered plantations of biofuel. This conflict between food and fuel is something that will have to be resolved democratically. And it doesn't mean we don't use biomass for fuel, but it does mean decentralized systems will be the only energy efficient way that do not threaten the food security of millions. My own journey for food freedom, and as I often say, you know, my romance for the quanta had to be given up for my romance for biodiversity. It began, of course, with starting to save seeds, setting up Navdanya. I think now we have about 30 community seed banks in different parts of the country. This year we have started creating seed banks for climate change, plants and seeds that can tolerate extreme drought, extreme flooding. And on flooding, I want to tell you, we have in the Ganges Delta a rice variety that grows 18 feet tall to be able to deal with the months and months and months of flooding in the Ganges Basin. And of course, the salt-tolerant rices. We want to keep these as open-source systems because we know there will be patents on salinity, there will be patents on drought, there will be patents on flood tolerance. And nature's creativity and farmers' creativity of thousands of years will once again be appropriated. And we want to ensure the freedom of evolution as well as the freedom of farmers and the freedom of eaters. The WTO defines the freedom of Monsanto to introduce food fascism. We define the freedom of seed as the freedom of farmers to save seeds, the freedom of farmers to breed new varieties, the freedom from privatization and biopiracy, freedom to have your own knowledge to be able to breed is critical to seed freedom and food freedom, freedom of farmers to exchange and trade seeds, freedom to have access to open source seed, freedom from genetic contamination and GMOs, freedom of the seed to reproduce because that freedom is being denied through the Terminator technology, and freedom to be able to continue to be part of a co-evolution that allows us to deal with all the ecological stress that the planet is facing. Unjust laws have to be disobeyed so that higher laws of the planet, higher laws of nature, higher laws of justice, higher laws of sustainability can be adhered to. So we have been practicing since 1991, when the early drafts of the GATT agreement, which became WTO, were released. We have been practicing what we call the Bij Satyagraha. Bij is seed, Satyagraha is the fight for truth. Last year, I gave to our Prime Minister 5 million signatures of farmers, communities, against a new seed law they wanted to introduce that would have made it illegal for farmers to have their own seeds. And we've repeatedly said to them, we have a duty to save seeds. We therefore cannot treat it as a crime. We refuse to be criminalized for performing our ecological duty for the planet and our communities. Food freedom involves being able to create alternatives where those alternatives have been destroyed, and defending and protecting those alternatives where they are being criminalized. It means upholding public health, upholding environmental protection, rural livelihoods as the highest objective of agriculture and food production. And the wonderful thing is that the more you work with nature, the more you help society. Usually we are told in the industrial paradigm that you have to destroy nature to feed people. You have to wipe out biodiversity to create industrial monocultures. All our studies in the last 2 decades have shown, and all our practices have confirmed, that the more diverse a farming system, the smaller a farm, the more local a market. The more food you produce, the better food you produce, the higher incomes farmers get, and the better food consumers get.
Dr. Vandana Shiva speaking last year at UBC. Thanks to Bonnie Faulkner and Alex Smith for their interviews used in this week's program. You can download a copy of this and previous episodes of the show on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.